This is study session after supper, the Thursday, the 8th of March, 73, with Rick and Debbie. And we're working on Whitman. Cowley first. Cowley on the 1855 poems. Channel 1 right. And a study session after supper, this Thursday, after supper, this 8th of March, 73, with Rick and Debbie. Channel 1 right and beginning to visit today's study session with Rick and Debbie. This is after supper, 8th of March, 73, Cowley on Whitman's 1855 poems. Channel 1 right, beginning of the study session with Rick and Debbie. This is after supper, 8th of March, 73, Cowley on Whitman's 1855 poems. Channel 1 right, beginning of the study session with Rick and Debbie. This is after supper, 8th of March, 73, Cowley on Whitman's 1855 poems.
Today was I read Cowley in the prose introduction. Never got to the poem. I in the prose introduction, I've just read it through once, so this is really the first thought. But it seems to me that Cowley says that uses that letter of Emerson's. And Emerson was so liked the first Leaves of Grass so much and said it was so unique, and I wondered if perhaps it wasn't that he thought he saw in Whitman that light that he's talking about, because in the prose introduction Whitman talks so much about the honesty and uniqueness of the poet, of the American poet, and that he has to say things simply and as they are and get around all the complications that people might set in his way. And perhaps Emerson saw this as...
Now, you think Cowley cleared things up?
I'm sorry.
You think Cowley cleared everything up pretty well?
Well, he hung it all on the Eastern philosophy. That's the way he reads the poem. And I thought that was interesting. The idea that Whitman might have had the same kind of experience that the Eastern mystics had, and he never read them. But you see the parallels there.
Yeah.
And he lines it out. His reading of the poem is the separate ecstasies that Whitman has. And he says that this is that Whitman presents it dramatically. One thing that I got hung up on was he speaks of the poem as he emphasizes that it's unified, it's all one thing, but he says it's like it's flowing, like flowing music, and it just keeps building and building and building. But where does it get? It's just continuing.
Yeah.
Continuing.
Where does it start from and where does it get?
It's maybe it was that I thought there wasn't any direction in it, if it was just flowing along. And he was having these ecstasies one after the other. What was he showing by that? Other than men can have religious ecstasies in a state of health as well as when they're fasting and hanging themselves by the thumbs.
Yeah, so then he reverses it on them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. Just what is the? Did we have it? Was there any direction to it? That I laid out last night. I guess not, was it? Well, I was looking for the Bardic thing where he takes liberties with common sense. And he takes a good thing. You wouldn't have to look very far to get him.
I've been through Cali, as far as I've been. You're pulling my head.
Well, I tell you what, we might as well just disband until you get to the point. You don't want to talk about Cali without pulling, do you?
No, I was a little irritated with Cali, though, because he seemed to just kind of slip this little introduction in on you. He starts out just talking, you know, that... Yes, Whitman read these books, but there are some other books he may have read, even though they weren't printed at his time, and he lists them, and then he goes into his whole lecture on Eastern philosophy.
Yeah.
I thought that was an awful, awful shaky basis for this whole thing.
Well, he's baiting you, you see. He assumes that's the way you feel about Whitman, and he says it's plausible, but it's not right. As he presents it. Now you've got your book.
But see, I haven't read it.
Well, what good are we going to do?
I'm just auditing.
You're auditing. We have full auditors and semi-auditors. Well, then, Sarah, I would make, if I could find it now, I would make one or two little statements. What did he call that first section?
Cali? The
introduction
of the
poet.
Yeah, what does he put into that?
He presents himself as a man who lives outdoors and worships his own naked body, and not the least of it is vile. And
well. Well, that takes in some of them.
He is in love with his deeper self, our soul, but he explains that can't be confused with mere personality.
Yeah. And not me, myself. I tell you what. This section that he calls the third sequence from 6 to 19 that he calls the grass. That's really the first poem, first one that there's something that you can hold on to, I think. A child said, "What is the grass?"
Mm-hmm.
And it's, is he looking backwards? I get the wrong side. Now he says several things about it, but I guess it is uniform hieroglyphic, and it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks and white folks, and everywhere. Now that's the grass as a commonplace. Now he. He states that, if you can see that as a statement, number 8, the little one sleeps in its cradle. I lift the gauze and look a long time, and silently a brush away flies. The youngster and the red-faced girl turn aside in the bushy hill. The blam of the pea, the tires of carts, and slough of boot soles, and talk of promenaders, the heavy omnibus, the driver with his interrogating son, the clank of the shod horses on the granite floor, the carnival of slaves. Now you see what he's doing. And the big doors of the country barn stand open and ready. The dried grass of the harvest time loads a slow drawn wagon. The clear light plays on the brown, gray and green interchange. Now the number 10 is away, but the others are close by, and he has 28 young men bathed on the shore, and 12, the butcher boy, puts off his killing clothes, sharpens his knife at the stall in the market. I loiter, enjoying his repartee and his shuffle and breakdown. Blacksmiths with grime and hairy chests environ the anvil. Each has his main sledge, and they're all out. There's a great heat in the fire. And in 13, the Negro holds firmly the reins of his four horses. The block swags underneath on its tied-over chain. The Negro that drives the huge dray of the stone yard, steady and tall, he stands poised on one leg on the string piece. His blue shirt exposes his ample neck and breast and loosens over his hip band. I behold the picturesque giant and love him, and I do not stop there. I go with the team also. And here, he just sticks in. Like Melville, really. In me, the caresser of life, forever moving. That's a kind of restatement of the grass. And what he's been doing, you see, with this illumination that he's had, is freedom from the bonds, Edward. Is that in this first edition? Freed from the bonds that would tie me? Where is that?
That should be in the introduction.
creeds in school is in abeyance. He puts that in later. Creeds and schools in abeyance, retiring back a while, suffice it what they are, but never forgotten. I harbor for good or bad, I permit to speak at every hazard, nature without check, with original energy. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
That's not exactly what I was looking for, but that's close enough. I see, he permits nature to speak without check. That is to say, you see, the bonds of society, they are loosed. And that's what he does, you see, here. And this is what's called Whitman's famous list, highly inartistic. But what the illumination has done for him is to free him from the bonds of institutions, and allows him, you see, this great leisure, and also free of art, these artistic bonds,
mm-hmm.
and lets him look at the just in that casual way. See, and what I assume is my loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear summer grass, and I presume that's a sort of a note of that leisure that he assumes. I tell you, you can go even farther than that. I forget these things. Yes, now that's nice. That next one, 30 to 30. What is it? 30 to 38. That's the one I was looking for. Now, see, that middle one there is the senses. I wrote twice. You see, that's the acuteness of the senses, and mine are not acute, so I can't go along with them on that. 30, that power of identification. that's the same thing as the one I was just looking at. And what he does here.
Is that all truth weigh in all things?
I believe a leaf of grass.
Oh, yeah. 31.
I don't follow Cali. I think I could turn and live a while with animals. Now, actually, this section should, as I see it, should begin on number 33. Now, what he does here, see, he projects, he has that leisure, but he does it on a more distant scale. You see, my ties and ballast leave me. He's not confined to the street scenes. That's number 33. I travel, I sail, my elbows rest in the sea gaps. I skirt the Sierras, my palms cover continents. I'm afoot with my vision. Now, you see, this takes him. This takes him so much farther. And through it. You don't have to even start at the beginning, you see. You can just pick it up anywhere. Just pick it up anywhere, scaling mountains, pulling myself cautiously up, holding on by low, scragged limbs, walking the path worn in the grass and beat through the leaves of the brush. I'm reading line 730. Where the quail is whistling betwixt the woods and the wheat lot, where the bat flies on the July eve, where the great gold bug drops through the dark, where the flails keep time on our barn floor, where the she-whale swims with her calves and never forsakes them. At the cider mill, at he festivals with blackguard jibes and ironical license and bull dances and drinking and laughter. At the cider mill, tasting the sweet of the brown squash, sucking the juice through a straw. At apple peelings, warning kisses for all the red fruit I find. At musters and beach parties and friendly bees and huskings and house raisings. Where the mockingbird sounds his delicious gurgles and cackles and screams and weeps, where the hayrick stands in the barnyard, where the hummingbird hymns. Now that's hardly skirting Sierras. I fly the night of the fluid and swallowing soul. I go hunting polar furs, you see. My voice, I understand the large hearts of heroes, the disdain and calmness of martyrs. I am the hounded slave. I wince at the bite of the dogs. Now he's still afoot with his vision. But his vision, you see, has to do simply with the commonplace. So it's not as exotic, you see, as it might appear. Mm-hmm. And he has very few statements, really. Most of it is just sort of circumstantial. And there he's loosed of the bonds of the art, I'd say, for one thing. Now, you see, the scholars will have to say that the art there is a masterpiece. They're just bound to say that. They just can't keep from it. Just leave it alone. If he writes it loose, leave it loose. So, now that's one thing, at least after 1835, that Whitman always had. He was loose jointed. And you see, he wore that slouch hat. And
stayed in the company of hundred ferrymen. Lumbermen.
He had followers that he saw occasionally. I think some of the articles show the things that he read. Allen in the biography shows the things that he was connected with, that he read, the currents of the time that he was connected with. And that, I think that's all in here too. And Cowley doesn't say it's not in here, but he says it's a good bit more, and you wouldn't read it just for that. So, you see, that's one of the freedoms he takes. And he doesn't imitate anybody, apparently. He doesn't. There's no external standards that he seemingly measures up to in this, as far as I can see. So you see, he never has that postponing. You see, that a scholar has.
Mm-hmm.
or framing and all like that, you see, that you do to suit people like this little request for grant. We should have sent that off this rough. As if we didn't have time to with it. Now, you see, what I'm doing is reading into it,
mm-hmm.
carrying the experience we had out here into this. and you see, the thing that that insight into the talk, into the people, their way of thinking, doing. The one thing it did out here was to sort of liberate us from the art forms, say the short story, the novel, or some sort of poetry that's difficult, it's beyond you, you might say. We take the minor forms where the premium is on seeing. And I think that's probably what he does. The premium there is on seeing. And you say we take it to the typewriter just to look at it. It's sort of important. I'm going to get me a rotten egg sometime.
Get one too.
Now this one's fairly clear, this 5th edition. It's pretty clean. It doesn't have his extravagances. I don't know when he starts out on those.
According to Callie, it's after he publishes this. It's
the 56th one?
Goes to
59.
Goes to his head, and that's what Callie says. And if he starts taking... Callie just says it takes liberties with the language. He invents words and uses foreign words that he doesn't understand.
But he doesn't do it in 5.
No.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Callie says it's the best.
Well, 56 doesn't change it too much, I don't think. Is it? Do you remember which one it is? 59?
Mm-hmm.
We'll find it. That'd be nice, too.
Says after 1855.
Yeah.
That's all. Just after the first.
Yeah.
Is the prose introduction in all of the editions? Or is this just in 1855?
Well, it stays with all of them, same one, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what he does, whether it changes it, maybe, I don't know.
When you read Candy, I remember, you just have the notion that he's always working a new edition of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's always on his mind.
Now, you see what you run into on that preface. The poet he talks about his term is foot. Mm-hmm. Now, that is the poet is Emerson scholar.
He's someone who can see and who has light.
Yeah.
Isn't that it?
Yeah.
Somebody who can get. Who's honest. He keeps saying you have to be honest and simple and say it the way it is. And that what's true for that for the poet who says it simply is true for all men, and that no actions of men are insignificant.
What you want to do is you want to get this along with Emerson. The poet does not deny the past. He thinks about the new life of the new form. Now, one thing you can do, and so much of what he says, he takes the same position as Emerson, but he goes much farther. Emerson has more traffic with the past than Whitman does. Whitman doesn't deny it. He doesn't give it much. He doesn't go in for it much. See, Emerson is a scholar. And when he talks about the way he got the idea, you see, he's got all that background in Swedenborg and Plato and Anne Hutchinson, he puts into several lines. It's that ideal philosophy, Platonic idealism, we want to call it. And see, Whitman doesn't know that to start with. He never learns it. He has no occasion to. But at any rate, you see, that's he doesn't deny the past. You see, but he thinks about the new life or the new forms, and this country, the United States, of poem. The history of the earth is the largest and most stirring. Stirring appear tame and orderly to their ampler largeness and stir. All the European history and the history in Palestine appear small compared to what goes on here. And that's not your point of view, is it? You haven't been brought up with Whitman. See, I believe with Whitman and Emerson. And I see a little bit more than new life and new forms, except I don't really see too much of that, the new life of the new forms. I don't know that I see this exactly, but I don't go any more, you see, for the European thing. Here at last is something in the doings of man that corresponds with the broadcast doings of the day and night. I don't think of those terms at all. Other states are seen in their deputies, executives of legislators, ambassadors, authors, colleges, churches, you see. But in this country, the common people. I don't think in those terms either. Do you? The poet catches this spirit, the great song of the Republic. Even in the lowly, as Thoreau's Canadian woodchopper, There is that indescribable freshness and unconsciousness about an illiterate person that humbles and mocks the power of the noblest expressive genius. Now, he's ahead of me there, you see. I didn't see that until I saw Miss Daisy. I didn't even get close to her until then. You see, no man, unconscious of an illiterate person. That was my first insight into it. I see in Whitman's world that half the people were illiterate, so they're a little different then. Not so much reading and writing. Now the poet catches his spirit, the great psalm of the Republic. Now the poet is a presence. He does not attract, analyze, argue, and just a presence, mere presence of the great poet conquers. And you see, in the poem, Whitman doesn't argue or reason. Is more a presence. I don't know anything like that in Emerson. In his presence is not left any vestige of despair or misanthropy or cunning or exclusiveness. No. Or the ignominy or the nativity of color or delusion of hell, and no man sense forward shall be degraded for ignorance or weakness or sin in the presence of the poet. I don't know anything like that. Beauty is not in rhythm, in rhyme or uniformity. See, that's his freedom in art. All beauty comes from beautiful blood and a beautiful brain, from health. This is what you shall do. Love the earth, but he's not physical.
That always surprised me.
He loves.
Mm-hmm.
He loves. Why? He loves and observes the sphere of summer grass. He's not running to see the sphere of summer grass. He's lying down all the time. He's passive. Maybe that's part of what he says here, that it's not, there's no struggle. He can't struggle. Or he'd be contradicting that. He can't have...
Oh, you see, I started out being physical. I used to do all sorts of push-ups and springboard things, you see, even on the concrete. I could spring 50 times on the concrete like a diving board. That's what happened to my foot. I always had. I ran 5 miles to the river. Just didn't jog. I didn't race. I never had any training. I just loved to do it. The poet is like John Turner, you see. The marked style, elegance, or effect originality. Poetic concern to carry on the heave of impulse and pierce intellectual depths and give all subjects their articulations of his powers. All can understand the poet, he says, come to us on equal terms. He makes statements on exact science, knowledge, political liberty. The poet brings light that fiction and romance do not have. Prudence. It has been thought that the prudent citizen was a citizen who applied himself to solid games. Only this is needed. Beyond the independence of a little sum laid aside for burial money and a few clapboards around and shingles overhead. I think that's so touching.
Isn't that though?
They had no use for money. Yeah. The prudence of the mere wealth and respectability of the most esteemed life is trifling. I see. What you have to do in a person like Whitman, if you go and part away with him, you've got to adopt his way of living as well as thinking. The poet will live if he does not flood himself with immediate aid, just with this, we're talking about that. The priests, a new order shall arise, and they shall be the priests of man, and every man shall be his own priest. They shall find their inspiration in real objects today. They shall not deign to defend immortality or God or anything else. You see, that makes them that defensive business. Now, didn't go that far. But you had a feeling he was headed in that direction. Elegant writing and the organic idea. Men seem to have lost the perception of the instant dependence of form upon soul. That's it. The statement runs into a strong mystic statement, the double meaning of every sensuous fact. For we are not pans and barrows. The fountains from which all the river of time flow are intrinsically ideal and beautiful. Hence, the three considerations of this essay, the nature and function of the poet, the means and materials he uses, the general aspect of art. Now, I don't get that, see that he follows that. Expression, poet, the poet as the seer, you see. The poet stands among partial men for the complete man. The men of genius receive of the soul, they are more himself, the young man, than he is himself. The poet is isolated among his contemporaries by truth and his art. But truth and the poet's art will attract all men sooner or later, for all men live by truth and stand in need of expression. The man is only half himself, the other half is his expression. I need to. I haven't been into this for some time. I'll have to get into it a little bit. Otherwise, I'll just be studying my lesson again, public.
So we have to read the poem.
Yeah.
This is a year's work.
If you're going to work in Whitman, I think you have to. I don't care if you're doing it for the first time or last time. I think you have to start with his poetry after his experience in the war. You see, the war took out all that arrogance, all that All that.
Yeah, he's getting the old
acting. Yeah. And the little bundle of poems that he did. You see the drum taps. All of those. None of those play with words. And he doesn't take any grand position. He doesn't skirt Sierras and things like that. That little thing, and it still has that freedom of rhetoric and form, but it comes from the feeling in it, from the thought. Wouldn't call it a thought, just like that little thing, the beat drums, blow, bugles blow, through the windows. Through doors, burst like a ruthless force. Enter the solemn church and scatter the congregation. Enter the school where the scholar is studying. Leave not the bridegroom quiet. No happiness must he have now with his bride. Nor the peaceful farmer any peace, plowing his field or gathering his grain. So fierce you were and pound. You see, drums do that. When you hear drums. I think the only time I ever heard drums was in the Sin Desert, out from Karachi. Just flat stretches of country. And we had left Bombay and gone up there waiting for orders to go across the hump. We had to wait our turn, so we waited there. We just sort of loose on the countryside, there wasn't anything to do. And after supper, in the dark, I could hear the drum. It's as far away as you could just barely hear. One little point of light. I remember I used to start out in that direction. I'd get over that little piece and I'd come on back. I had that drum in my ears all the way. After I got there and seen what they were doing, you see, it's unspecified, like James does in the time of truth, the evil of the boy, a little boy is unspecified, it makes it stronger. Well, you don't see what they're playing the drums for, and it's out in the night. It brings these things to life, and he's heard those. He's heard them. And you have to hear them. That's very simple. Beat drums, blow bugles blow, over the traffic of cities, over the rumble of wheels in the streets, our beds prepared for the sleepers. See, this little thing with no rhythm, seemingly it just comes to life, especially with voice. You can run through it, you see, and with that, what, that
Understanding.
Instant understanding, you see, you get from a piece of paper. simplest. Now, this little saying, 1861, he thinks of it as a year. Armed year. Year of the struggle. No dainty rhymes or sentimental love verses for you, terrible year. Not you as some pale portling seated at the lisping cadences piano, but as a strong man erect, clothed in blue clothes, advancing, carrying a rifle on your shoulder. It's the 1861. As a strong man erect. So you see, it's not quite fair. I see all the countryside as these through Whitman. Touched with Whitman. See, what I would do too if I could, you see, is to have some of that freedom from the artistic treatment. And that leisure that he has. If you have one little statement, one little picture, you see, the child said, "What is a grass?" How do I know what the grass is? But it's just something that grows everywhere. You see, if you could somehow get that into the countryside, I can't do it. But if you could. I don't go much later on than Whitman and Twain, you see. After that, they're all too intelligent and true and brilliant. And all, you see, Faulkner has all that rhetoric. And Henry James has that terrible concentration. You read one little chapter, a little bitty old chapter, you know, and you feel like a dish rag. It's so intense. Something that's unknown before him. I'd stop before that if I could. Part of it you can see in all the people you've met over here, they still have a little of this leisure. You see, they're not waiting at a green light. Not when they're over here. They still have it with all those pauses. Somehow, if you could get get the pauses. If you could transcribe it a little bit and just get some of the pauses, you can't do it. You see, that everybody would read through them. They deserve it. They ought to have it, and that's one of the problems. Whitman doesn't have that intensity. You see, they do. And along with it, they've got such an extraordinary charge, mental charge. You see, that little thing, the murder in the cathedral, I suppose that's about as visible as anything Eliot did, and even his treatment of those soldiers. It has such a charm. I don't have the floor. What do we do? Go to bed?
Remember those things that Canby talks about so much? That Whitman just charm with his talk. All he had to do was just open his mouth and talk. And the great and the small and everybody else would just listen. He used to
make. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Well, you get Canby where he says that.
I sure will. Mm-hmm. You know, he had in groups, they'd meet almost like the coffee shop people.
This specimen is, you see, I'm not a footman. I don't know much about her. But, Specimen Days, you see, all these things he does, my passion for ferries and Broadway sights and the printing office and old Brooklyn, my first reading and the visit of Lafayette and those things. And now you see, Broadway sites he has, and omnibus jaunts and drivers, and plays and operas too, and certain actors and singers had a good deal to do with the business. All through these years, off and on, I frequented the old park, the Bowery, Broadway, and Chatham Square theaters, and the Italian operas at Chambers Street, Astor Place, or the Battery. Many seasons was on the free list, writing for papers even as quite a youth. The old Park Theater, what names, reminiscences, the words spring back. Placide, Clark, Miss Vernon, Fisher, Clara Fisher, Miss Wood, Miss Seguin, and all of those were gifted, you see. It was a period of very poor plays and great actors. Great, I mean, remarkable actors. You see, all of those, seeing all of that in his ears. It has this opening of the secession war and this battle of Bull Run. That's the first defeat that they had. He says a great and cautious national official predicted that it would blow over in 60 days, and folks generally believe the prediction. I remember talking about it on a Fulton ferry boat with the Brooklyn mayor, who said he only hoped the Southern fighters would commit some overt act of resistance, as they would then be at once so effectually squelched we would never hear of secession again. But he was afraid they never would have the pluck to really do anything. I remember too that a couple of companies of the 13th Brooklyn who rendezvoused in the city armory and started since as Saturday men were all provided with pieces of rope conspicuously tied to their musket barrels, with which to bring back each man a prisoner from the audacious South to be led in a noose on our men's early and triumphant return. Remember that? All this sort of feeling was destined to be arrested in reverse by a terrible shock. The Battle of the First Bull Run, certainly, as we now know it, one of the most singular fights on record. The defeated troops commenced pouring into Washington over the Long Bridge at daylight on Monday, the 22nd. Day drizzling all through with rain. The Saturday and Sunday of the Battle of the 21st had been parched and hot to an extreme. The dust, the grime, and smoke and layers sweated in, followed by other layers again sweated in, absorbed by those excited souls, their clothes all saturated with the clay powder filling the air, stirred up everywhere on the dry roads and trodden fields by the regiments, warming wagons, artillery. All the men with this coating of murk and sweat and rain, now recalling back, pouring over the Long Bridge. A horrible march of 20 miles, returning to Washington baffled, humiliated, panic struck, and he has left that easy night, that easy scene. In that prose, it's really not prose. So that you don't need regularity. You see, regularity would disturb it. You see, you see, he says, where the vaunts and the proud boasts with which you went forth? Where are your banners and your bands of music? And your ropes to bring back your prisoners? Well, there isn't a band playing, and there isn't a flag but clings ashamed and lank to its staff. It's rather poor prose. And you can read it without any content at all. Could be, you see, I've been reading this for a long time. It could be this is sort of where I learned to project into what the countryside says, Faye. Because that prose is not adorned and no rhetoric in it to gain your attention. But I don't need any, I don't want any. Last thing I want is some sort of prose. They have a remarkable language.
Yeah.
To me, that's what comes through. But you see now, I see them through You see, I don't see them through the European scholars. Thoreau is not too far from that. His prose is nicer, you know, but it's quiet. Well, let's see. Let's try that little business. Do I have the letters in here?
Yeah. Most of them. What I gave you was another document to go with it. Is there a copy of the letter you wrote? Be the cover letter, this, and the narrative statement that we're going to send off. And,
how much you got there? You know, is that what you did?
This is the brief. Just state a little more in letter form. And,
let's hear it.
For the past 5 years, I've devoted most of my energies to an inquiry into the kind of talk I've found in rural areas of Alachua County. This kind of talk has often been assumed, mistakenly, to be long-winded and glorifying the past, and therefore disregarded. The beginnings of my inquiry were in 1967, when the campuses were plagued with disorder. During that troubled summer, Eric Fromm said to Edwin Newman in a televised interview that one more of our country's dislocations is education, which now consists largely of abstractions that students can no longer turn into experience. I was pulled at that time by seeing these dislocations, this dislocation among students I taught, and seeing, too, that it did not exist among people in a rural area I was deliberately making contact with. My cue was the talk. In the rural areas, I was hearing a talk I had heard nowhere else before, a talk none of my bright students seemed capable of. In the fall of 68, the inquiry took shape, and was researched for the next 3 years. The statement that made all the research possible was one I worked out in that fall of 68. It was that the talk of the countryside is informative by nature, and the content is experience. The contrast to this talk now so common, to this is the talk now so common that is basically Freudian. It is our sensitive reaction to what we think people think about us. It puts a premium on adjusting to what we think we are expected to do and say. The people of these rural areas are not college or professional people. Since I now live in this area where I conduct my research, most of these with whom I talk are my friends and neighbors. I call them the countryside. I have no proper label. They live in the country, but many now have jobs in town, so the distinction disappears. It is true of myself. My roots are small town and tenant farmer. But in town I work at the university, using the literature from Chaucer to Wordsworth to Twain. I do not specify age, origin, area, or social standing of the countryside. They have settled here from all over the United States. Their ages range from 20 to 95. They are not underprivileged or seeking social justice, nor are they old-timers in a backward area. What is specific about the countryside is the talk. It is not abstract or critical. They do not talk well about their own personalities or conditions of the present time. Their lives and conversations are calmer for not being heated up by solid abstraction, as in Donald Staffler's book, Future Shock. I look at their talk as reporting on experience. One of my neighbors comes over and says, "I've got something to tell you. I thought I lost a cow." and we hear the sustained, circumstantial account of a cow that got hung in some machinery. What my neighbor does is to look at the experience, then report on what she saw. It is entirely visible. It is interesting, as she is using her experience. A wholly different side of this research is the young people, mostly students, with whom I have worked. I have more information on the student mind in this kind of research than I do on the countryside. They are so much more accessible and flexible. The world they come from conditions them against invasions of privacy, and I find they cannot report on their own experience or look at other people. But then they see that with the countryside, nothing is really private. It is all matter for talk. Slowly, this key unlocks the words. They hear the countryside report on experience, and it sends them to their own, mostly to experience they didn't know they had. One of my close associates put in several years as a bag boy at a supermarket when he was growing up. He was perfectly willing to discard it, until he saw what the countryside did. And over a period of several weeks, he worked on nothing else and resurrected the experience. It is a scholarly effort on the part of these young people to enter the world of talk in the countryside. But the countryside grew up with a gift. It is in their culture. My research is heavily documented. Notes, daily commentary, and written studies cover it. I have done extensive tape recording of the talk of the countryside, all spontaneous. I saw early that it was necessary, as I could get so little from hearing the talk one time. Some of the tapes are rough field tapes made on cassette machines. Some was made on reel-to-reel machines and is of studio quality. On Sunday, 15th of August, 1971, I realized that the first part of this long inquiry would have to come to an end. I would have to surface and make known what I had seen. That academic year I spent on campus looking for a niche. I found no one tried to stop me, but no one would put down the literature of Chaucer or Milton or Shakespeare to look at the work I had done with living human beings. At first, we proposed to store the documents in a library for future use, but I saw that if it was not used and interpreted now, it could never be properly used. So as it turns out, I become more important than the documents. I have had some clear time to work with my material, and some scholarly young people who work for me full time. But my free time will end, and the young cannot work on and on for only their keep.
I didn't realize it read so well.
No, he turned it.
Well, it's been polished a little.
He worked.
It's been turned, yeah.
Well, and then you know it well enough that you can read it. You know, too.
And then there's Debbie's letter.
Yeah.
This comes out real nice. Dear sir, my need is outlined in the enclosed documents, and those documents would be this and then the narrative statement. I have spent the last 3 years researching the nature of talk among people who are my friends and neighbors in Alachua County, Florida. I supported the research myself. Now I find that I need outside support if I am to make the material I have collected available to the public and continue to collect similar documents in the same manner. There are two ways in which I can do this. I need the funds to copy, edit, and organize the documents I have now, and I need the funds to support a staff who can help me take the documents to the public and interpret them for the public. A part of this interpretation would be to find uses for the documents with museums, libraries, universities. It has been suggested that the bicentennial activities in Florida might be part of this research I have done. However, none of this would be possible unless the records I have collected are edited and interpreted, and I cannot continue without a grant. I enclose a brief statement of how the research took shape and where it is now. It is not a formal request for a grant. It is not in the language of grants. I could put it in that language if I received your applications for a research grant in language from your organization. Thank you for your consideration.
Sure.
That, I really think that clicks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Put your mind to it.
And I thought the only thing maybe would need to be added was that the research of the inquiry has several prongs, so it might fit in several categories. Mm-hmm. I think it's in applications
mm-hmm.
from language or whatever parts of their development.
there's another division called social science with humanistic emphasis, and it might go into that as
yeah,
well
that's
as
the
language
one that's
or linguistics.
So general.
That's most vague getting my head.
In fact, it's right here. Aspects of the social sciences which have humanistic content and employ humanistic methods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, get onto that. Oh dear.
And I took just a little small look at that youth grant. You're not, they don't even want you to be working on a degree.
No?
Mm-mm. And you very definitely come onto that.
Project must relate in a clear way to the humanities and must have a specific purpose, carefully designed in scope, and a high promise of helping individuals develop their critical facilities. I made it so far. Adults may be involved, but it must be designed primarily for young people. That's it.
And it goes on to say that it's not for purposes of PhDs or our master's thesis or anything.
Up to 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like people for underprivileged. Consideration will be given first to projects by persons who have not completed professional training.
I'd be working on something like this, you see.
Do you think you ought to have enclosures on you?
I don't know. The impression I got is the letter is just kind of exploratory.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That this is almost maybe pushing it, sending as much information. I don't think it hurts anything at all. They would send you the forms and start asking for specifics if they're really interested. I think this is mostly to see if you're going to qualify, which you shouldn't have any trouble.
You'd show this to Gabrielli. And then
yeah.
I asked him about the youth thing. And what he thinks about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I believe y'all are getting places. Die.
And I think the narrative statement will really go well with them. Just send it off.
But you don't want to send it at the wrong time. That's your point.
At what?
At the wrong time.
I was thinking it could go with this.
Yeah.
Well, you could ask.
Yeah. That was why I wanted to talk to Gavinelli.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, he knows what how it should read.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's almost enough just to send this.
Yeah.
Yeah, just what you read.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think.
Right, yeah. I still like that narrative statement. It just has a feeling about it, I think. But this, you know, you think they wrote this, somebody up there wrote this, and you can see where they don't quite know. You see. They can't make their purpose clear.
Last night, Faye, I had to use a third degree. over here. Let me talk a little bit about something
else. No. She wrote that letter. That's a good day's work.
Not for her. Who had done the one for Warren?
Both of us. Well, I think we settled on was kind of an outline of things to mention.
Yeah.
We were going to say, you know, that you were a member of the staff, and that the work had strong humanistic content, and that it had something about the students that would work with you. And I was thinking maybe you'd say one of the few people that not only taught the literature but used it.
Well, don't forget the marketplace.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's what I meant.
Yeah. And,
I mean, so many will just let you write term papers.
Marketplace and living in a bed.
Yeah, yes.
Well, you can't.
There's a poet up there, Stoffler, what's his name? Nice fellow. Came by, and he didn't go to your meeting, and I asked him, you missed it. He said he'd let, he had a class, he'd let the other person in. And I tried to get him to talk a little bit, but he wasn't much interested. And, see, what did I say? Something or other. This marketplace was a little hard to get to. He said, yes, he preferred to stay in the 19th century and just read the periodicals and see what their attitude towards the marketplace were. Literary sources, all of it, literary sources, you see. I don't think, say, I don't think, I see, Rick has seen a little bit more of it, Debbie, but you see, since she's been here, we've really just been coasting, and the effort and the manipulation that went into these sessions, she's just seen a...
You really ought to get in on it. You know what, we've got to do it, I guess, just for Debbie's sake. We've simply got to manipulate Frankie, just to show her how we have to do it.
Well, I don't want to do it anymore. See, the first thing that happened when Rick got on here, and Faye was gone, I was by myself, and
with a bibliography.
And we did that damn Patterson.
Oh.
That almost killed me.
They almost had me coming back over here on an emergency. It almost had me have Don fly me back.
Yeah.
I thought the ceiling had fallen in.
It's all on tape. The only misfortune was his first session, he got taped over it. That was fairly quiet and a fairly sustained one. But you always do things like that. And that's the only misfortune. The rest of it was, I'm telling you, it raised a hair. I can see it over there now, back and forth.
David,
if they hadn't heard these, I don't think anything was quite as hot as that. We
didn't have quite the leisure some of them had. No.
David, one day. One day Coleman and Miss Annie were over here, and Suzanne was here with two of her friends, graduate students. Well, what we wanted was Coleman to talk, and we wanted to get Miss Annie out of the room.
We wanted Miss Annie to talk too, but
she wouldn't cooperate. So Guy says, get her out. Suzanne says, how'll I do it? He says, hell, I don't care, get her out. So we phoned Miss Annie off to one of the graduate students, and what was her name? Susie. She didn't know what to do with it. She'd come up with Miss Annie, they'd come up talking, she'd start in, I'd say, go on out, keep her out. So it was the biggest madhouse it ever was, but we got the tape with Coleman.
Yeah.
It took all three of us to keep Miss Annie outside.
Yeah.
We talked about flowers. We dug up flowers.
She just didn't want to sit and talk.
You should have seen us running around. Just keep it from being obvious, you know. We'd spell each other on keeping Miss Annie out of the kitchen. And when they finally left, we just had to go off and sit down and rest. It was hard on us.
Yeah, have a good talk. Coleman really came to life.
And he was in here just talking so good.
Now, you know Coleman.
I've never met Coleman.
Well, see, that's the trouble. You ought to get to know the rest of them.
Yeah, we started up there.
Best you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, that was a small thing. It just seemed like every day was something like we were having to manipulate that. Back when Suzanne was really on that.
Oh, it's just one after another. You see, Coleman was able to fend for himself way back at the time to see a white man could just take his mules away from him. He was always able to fend for himself. He was a pretty sturdy fella, for one thing. And you can see it in his talk. And he's got that, he goes back like Mr. Weaver to the 20s of the war. On that River Styx Road.
Miss Mary Sunday was talking about Coleman killed. Well, he came to, he's in his wagon and buckboard and had Emma hitched to it, and he came to, he was riding along this little road, and there's a great big gator lying across it. Tremendous. So he just killed him. He didn't know he was against the law. And she had this story about, she said, Coleman, you get that thing here down in a hurry. They'll have you in the tent.
Hello? Is it Mr. Richardson? Well, let me call him. Not Debbie's time, Ray. You have to tell us something. You're our chief reporter. Oh, you got arrested. You haven't reported on anything all day. I'll turn this thing off, or you won't be about it. Is that a fan still on?
Yeah.
Who turned that on in the first place?
I did.
Gosh, old man. No wonder I get in the willies. Well, tell us about your experiences with Whitman.
Flight. When I took one course in American literature.
Yeah.
And we read a lot of Hawthorne. We read Hawthorne the first semester and the second semester. We read Hawthorne, I guess. But we read about three or four essays of Emerson in 1 week. And we read Song of Myself in about another week. We read Hawthorne. I've read a lot of Hawthorne. I have the complete works, and we read an awful lot of Hawthorne. We had to read The Marble Faun and Scarlet Letter and about 20 of the tales. It just depends, you know, on I guess the man's point of view that you're studying with, you know. I had him again when I was a senior. He was my tutor for I had for Faulkner again, and then for Milton and Sampson. The one that wrote me the note about getting a dictionary. The only thing I ever remember about writing papers for him was that he didn't like it if you made any typographical errors.
Yeah.
He used to lower your grade a letter if you made too many errors. The content, let the subject be what it may, but typing better be pretty good. So I haven't had any experience with Whitman here before.
I'm not exactly certain what authors you are experiencing. You just read here, there, and yonder.
A real smattering.
Well, that may be the secret of your success.
No doubt.
That's what Barbara used to say, you know. When she got home, she threw her books over behind the trunk of the bed. And I think she did. She was scholarly. But she wasn't bookish to any great extent. She didn't just live in books. And a good thing. That is, from my point of view. Thank you.